We probably all know what the challenge is, and today in particular, we know what that challenge is, and it's basically the loss of the remaining wildlands on the earth, in part due to increased land use surrounding these wildlands, increased recreation and other uses within them, and climate change. This is happening globally. Here are results of a recent study that looked at this period of 1993 to 2010 and basically found that among the large wildland units globally, that some almost 11% were lost during that time period. Within the Western U.S., Dave Theobald, speaking just about a year ago in this forum, mentioned his work that documented a loss of a football field's worth of natural area about every 2.5 minutes in the West during this 2001 to 2011 period. This cartoon might be somewhat illustrative of the problem. The fence, it's called, we call it a fence, they're saying here in 8000 BC. It keeps out the drafts and the lions and the elephants. And then in 1500 AD, here's what the earth looks like. And in 1800, and now currently, we call it a wildlife preserve. It keeps in the drafts and the lions and the elephants. So what my talk is all about today is to what extent this is happening globally and what we can do about it. Now, here in the Northern Rockies, you know, we're really fortunate because we have these remarkable mountain ranges, and they're largely public land. Oh, I see my graphics are not functioning properly, so most of the study is grayed out. Basically, what this shows is that most of these mountain systems are public lands, and that the places where we actually live and we grow crops, which are the brighter colors, are a relatively small proportion of our landscape, mostly in the valley bottoms. So we might be much better off than many places in the world. And it more or less leads to the question for Yellowstone National Park and Grand Teton National Park, basically how well are we sustaining the ecological health of this place? So I'd like to, in terms of topics tonight, I'd like to first talk about why do we call this a greater ecosystem, and why do we think it's important to map it and manage it at this larger spatial scale, larger than the national park? What sorts of human pressures have been building in the system over the last 100 years or more, and what are the projections for the future? How is the ecosystem responding to those human pressures? And then finally, I'll summarize some of these ecological consequences in terms of analysis of trends in what we call vital signs of ecosystem health, basically a report card for how well we're taking care of the ecosystem. And then importantly, try to end talking about potential solutions, basically a framework by which we can keep the fence, keep the wildlands covering as much of the earth as possible, particularly with a particular focus on the U.S. So these ideas are pretty much all other people's ideas. I'm just sharing them with you. I want to acknowledge folks in my lab that have done a lot of the research that we'll talk about tonight. And then additionally, folks from around Greater Yellowstone, like Mike Clark, who I know is in the audience, and Tom Olof and Dennis Glick and many others that have really developed key concepts and approaches in the system and have helped me try to understand the situation, and finally from these various funding sources. Okay, so let's start with why a greater ecosystem. This will probably be pretty familiar ground to you all. Basically, over the last many millennia, geomorphic processes, particularly continental plate tectonics and volcanism, have basically created the Yellowstone Plateau and the surrounding mountain ranges. So we have this high elevation system that is perched above the surrounding plains. And that sets up quite complex topography that influences climate, such that climate is quite harsh in the higher elevations and more equitable down in the valley bottoms where we tend to live. And then there's really a mixture of soil fertility from quite infertile due to volcanic influence to more fertile. These sort of abiotic gradients become really important when it comes to sort of large-scale ecological processes. Of course, those high mountains are capturing the snowfall that's feeding the seven large rivers that run off the Yellowstone Plateau and sustain these remarkable blue ribbon trout streams and aquatic communities, even during the summer low-flow months. On the terrestrial part of the system, we have patterns of primary productivity, basically plant growth that's very patchy, being fairly low up in Yellowstone Park on average and at the higher elevations, and particularly high in the lower forest areas and down in the valley bottoms. And then over the course of the growing season, of course, the pattern of productivity tends to move up slope, so that in August, the places that have the highest grassland productivity are actually up in the northern range of Yellowstone Park. And then disturbances like fire tend to spread across the system, and those initiate patterns of succession. So we have this wonderful complexity of serial stages spread across the terrestrial area and across the floodplains and riparian zones. Those sorts of abiotic patterns and processes influence very strongly where different types of species live in the system and how they use the system. So here are just four groups of species that tend to use the area in different ways. You're familiar with the ungulates that migrate from the lowlands to the uplands over the course of the annual cycle, largely to capitalize on the patterns of that greening vegetation, those areas of high productivity. You might not know that our native trout tend to do the same thing, actually moving 50 to 70 kilometers from main stem rivers and lakes up to headwaters for spawning. So we have these species that are migrating across these elevational gradients in the system. There's other species like whitebark pine and pica and wolverine that, strangely enough, mostly occupy the high elevation, the subalpine areas, the places that are coldest, deepest snows. They're particularly adapted to those environments. On the other hand, the great majority of species tend to hang out down in the valley bottoms, in these along the major rivers where these well-developed riparian communities of cottonwood and aspen exist. So this map is just showing in green places of high numbers of breeding bird species, and then in this orange color where the woody vegetation is particularly diverse. And then finally, we have species like wolves and grizzly bears that require very large home ranges. They pretty much are everywhere. They're generalists that occupy the whole system. So the point is, when you put this all together, basically you come to the conclusion that as big as Yellowstone Park is and Grand Teton Park, they're not big enough to capture these ecological dynamics. And hence, for more than the last 50 years, we've recognized that, in fact, the greater ecosystem really is the unit that we need to understand and we need to manage. Well, now, that's all the ecological stuff, but of course, this seminar series is sponsored by the Center for Western Lands and Peoples. That brings together social scientists with natural scientists. And a lot of the folks in the audience would be quick to say that, well, now this becomes a an important question about people, because this greater ecosystem includes many different federal jurisdictions. It includes several counties. It includes several states. It includes private lands that have a diversity of types of stakeholders. So we have lots of people of different interests that occupy this ecosystem. And when it comes to how do we meet the needs of those people and maintain the health of the ecosystem, you know, that's no small challenge. That's no small challenge at all. So let's look a little bit at this, at basically the role of people in the ecosystem. Up until the last century, this was a place that people more or less used either seasonally or in low numbers. That was true for most Native American groups, and it was also true for the Euro-American settlers. So this area tended to be populated by Euro-Americans much later than most of the U.S., and hence the last major battle between Native Americans and Euro-Americans was as recently as almost 1880. Well, that remoteness that kept people away and the harsh climate that kept people away, that became an attractor, as you all know. That's probably the reason why many of you are here. In the 1970s, the population of GYE started increasing fairly rapidly. There was a hiatus in the 80s, but then again, starting about 1990, very sustained growth in numbers of people and also in the number of homes in the system. So basically, in that time period, since 1970, the population's more than doubled. Over the last 5 years, each year, we've added almost 4,500 residents to GYE, and maybe amazingly, we've added 4,800 homes per year to the system. And it leads to the Bozeman Chronicle coming out with headlines like this. The blue here is basically showing all the rural homes mapped across Greater Yellowstone. When we did this map now about 10 years ago, I guess I personally was just stunned that even the most remote corners of GYE are places where we have this rural residential development and ranchette development. When we think about the total footprint, the total location of places where we're growing crops and where we have ex-urban homes and suburban and urban areas, it's shown in red here. It now occupies about 31% of GYE. Again, a bit of surprising that what's thought of as the largest intact ecosystem in the lower 48, basically some 31% of it we would consider developed. What about the future? Well, if one just projects the growth rates over the last 40 years, to 2050, basically that results in about a 2.5-fold increase in population over that 32-year period. And in terms of home density, a 4-fold increase in number of homes. Pretty dramatic. So Todd Wilkinson, who's here in the front, he really in an article in his recently developed online journal, the Mountain Journal, basically described these projected growth patterns across GYE and has this rather striking diagram of Bozeman becoming more like the size of Minneapolis currently and his rendition of that, and Salt Lake sort of coming into the southern end of the system. So this is pretty heady stuff about where we're going into the future. If the ecosystem feels like it's under some pressure now, what will that pressure be like, you know, in the coming decades? And of course, the folks that are living here, most of them are like us. They're also getting out into the backcountry and recreating. It turns out, as has been recently documented by the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, there's really not very good data on backcountry usage and how it's changed over time. Fortunately, Yellowstone, let's go back here. Fortunately, Yellowstone Park does keep visitor records, and of course, we're familiar with each of the last 4 years breaking the previous record for the number of people visiting the park. Not only do we not know much about overall backcountry usage, we don't know much about its impacts. And this is an area where the College of Letters and Sciences is teaming up with the Greater Yellowstone Coalition to do a conference on this this spring. And so that'll be something hopefully you'll be interested in participating in, and we can all learn more about this. I think we're probably not too far away from what's depicted here, where the warden shows up and conservation area. It's okay, we're all conservationists. So, of course, it really raises questions about our impacts in the backcountry and how we can tend to minimize those. Well, people are not only influencing the earth through land use and where we live and play, but also through the greenhouse gas contributions and change in climate. These are just the documented changes in temperature, about a 2 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature in GYE since 1950, and a projection to 2100 of a 5 to 10 degree Fahrenheit increase. So a fourfold to fivefold increase in the warming that you all have already experienced in this system so far. Precipitation is projected to increase, but this warming leads to higher rates of evaporation and an aridity index that's actually been getting more moist over the last 100 years is projected to become more dry in the coming century as a result of this warming. So when we think about the ecological consequences, you know, we as humans, we tend to think about our relationship with nature one of two ways. I kind of like this one where the two little cavemen aside of the mastodon that got their little arrow in them, and okay, we shot him, but now what? Nature is too big and too powerful for us to influence, versus Larson's view of wildlife preserves. So I guess really what I'd like to do now is look at which of these two tends to represent the human impact on ecological stuff in Yellowstone. It's actually, for ecologists, it's not very easy to answer the question of how well are we taking care of a place ecologically? How well are we taking care of an ecosystem? We convened a workshop of international scientists funded by NASA about a year ago to address this question of what are ways to actually take the pulse of a system that's comprehensive and objective and meaningful to people that make decisions. We'd like to thank the B-Bar Ranch. They hosted this meeting, as they do for other conservation activities at no cost during the winter months. And so that's just one example of some of the great social synergy that, you know, that happens in the system that's helpful. Well, one of the things that we came up with in this group was basically this notion of a land health index, where we would use the variety of types of high-quality satellite data and other data to basically monitor key ecological vital signs relating to the stressors of the system, such as land use, weather and climate, water, habitat, individual species, ecological processes. So this level three, this is kind of the detailed stuff that the scientists really sort of fret about and study in great detail. This level one is probably what policymakers are more interested in. And so this is designed to take the detailed science and try to put it in a form that is more meaningful to the public and to policymakers. Anyway, what I'd like to do now is just, for some of these topics, talk about some of the ecological impacts of climate change and land use change across the system. Dean Ray mentioned that we were fortunate to have completed a five-year study of ecological response to human pressure in the Northern Rockies and in the Appalachians. We're actually able to use quite sophisticated NASA ecological hindcasting and forecasting tools, something that NASA Earth Science has developed over the last 10 years at the cost of many millions of dollars, and applied that system to the problem of wildlands. And then this is the book that the dean mentioned that has all the results of that and that you could consult if you want more information about some of the stuff I'm talking about. Okay, well, ecological consequences with regard to some ecological process stuff, with regard to snow and runoff and hydrologic integrity. Greg Peterson has through paleo studies, basically determined that snowpack in Greater Yellowstone is about 20% lower in the last two or three decades than over the 800-year period, largely related to the changes in temperature that we saw earlier. Things like the effects of damming and this loss of snow and then withdrawal of water for irrigation, of course, has led to declines in stream discharges. All the major rivers in GYE have showed a significant reduction in discharge, particularly during those critical July and August months. And it's those low flows and record high temperatures that have led to the things like the massive fish kill that happened last year in the Yellowstone, with really important economic and social consequences, as well as has led to, most of you are probably fishermen, what do you think about eastern smallmouth bass being in the Yellowstone River? You know, that's an eastern warm water species. Not in our system, no. Anyway, that's an example of the types of invasions that are starting to happen in this place. In terms of long-term forest dynamics, these are some things you might know less about. Scott Powell within our lab basically chronicled a major expansion of conifer forest from about the late 1800s to the year 2000. This is just showing one place 100 years apart over in the Paradise Valley. And then this is the result of his mapping based on satellite imagery of places during this 1985 to 2000 period where conifer forests were lost. And of course, those are the places burned in 1988 fires. But the light green are places where conifer is expanded. And actually, that's a much larger area than was burned in the 88 fires. This expansion is probably due to the change in climate and fire exclusion through human activities, among other factors. Since 2000, the story's flipped around, showing how there often are these nonlinearities in ecological response. So, of course, we've had a major die-off of subalpine forests over the last 10 years or so. Tony Chang within our lab was able to develop a model based on temperature to predict bark beetle outbreaks and to predict consequences for pine species and their survival in the system. These are maps of Greater Yellowstone for each decade from 1950 up to 2010. And the colors represent the probability of mortality due to that warming. And then this is just the area covered by the areas of predicted mortality. So this period of 2000 to 2010, due to those the warming that I described, set up a much higher probability of forest mortality than has occurred any time in the last 50 years. That's important because a lot of you might remember in the 60s and 70s was another big die-off, and a lot of people say this is part of a natural cycle, which it is. I guess this study tends to conclude that this natural cycle is being exacerbated by this climate warming. And so now we shift from an expansion of conifer forests to a decline. For what other sort of resources might we see this sort of change from a positive sign to a negative sign as the stressors continue? Those are the kind of things that really matter and really make a difference when it comes to long-term consequences. You know, natural disturbance is critical in this system. This is a fire-driven system. Many species are dependent on the natural fire regime that's occurred here. Of course, that's exactly true for the floodplains as well, with the periodic floods basically driving that diversity of riparian habitats and keeping them highly productive. What we've seen over the since about the year 2000 is an increase in acres burned. So in 1988, of course, that was the big fire and a huge amount of area burned. And in fact, this diagram, the amount burned then is even higher than indicated here. And there were relatively few fires during the 1990s, but since 2000, the number of fires has increased. And particularly, so the Douglas fir are in the lower elevation areas. It's particularly the lower elevation areas like the wildland-urban interface where we've had this increase in fire in this most recent period, again, probably associated with the warming. But we now have homes in those low-elevation forests, and so that very much influences the ability of managers to let natural fire burn in the system and do its ecological good. We now really are trying to suppress those fires in order to protect people and homes. And, of course, the same thing is true in our floodplains. This is Livingston during a flood period. Since those big floods in 1996 and 97 in the Yellowstone, we've added a very large number of homes that are right down on that floodplain. And now we're having to riprap the banks in order to keep the river in its place instead of allowing it to expand and create those diverse cereal habitats. My wife's in the audience. She knows this picture pretty well. Our house is right up in here. This was the year 2000. I guess the short version is she and I were there with seeing the fire coming. Our neighbors all showed up, and they came into the house and said, "What do you want us to take out? The fire's coming." And we said, "Oh, the kids are safe. We're safe. Leave it all here." But one of the neighbors said, "No, you're going to need some underwear." So he starts bringing that out. And they all leave. The fire is continuing to come. A fire truck shows up. It's a foam truck operated by a couple of volunteers. They park in the driveway, and they wait and wait. And as the fire approaches, I'm saying, "Guys, it's time. Put the foam on." And then all of a sudden, they say, "No, it's too early." All of a sudden, the fire just explodes 80 meters away on the skyline. What do? They get in the truck and drive away. We're out of here. And I'm on the roof with my hose that's just going, pshhh. And amazingly, the wind, which had been blowing 30 or 40, just died, and the fire dropped right out of the trees, and the house was spared. But it was a real lesson for us about what it means to live in that urban wildland interface. We now live over on South Fifth, about six blocks from here. And then let's talk a little bit about habitats and about species. You may have seen this map. We basically, when we mapped those rural homes, we also did field studies and then used satellite imagery to basically map these bird hotspots, places of high numbers of species. And you see that the two overlap a bunch, that basically, you know, intense human land use does tend to overlap with the places that native species tend to like. That can have some pretty big influence on the types of species that are present. So this is just a generalization for many studies about as you go from the wildland through exurban land uses through urban, different groups of species thrive or do poorly along that gradient. So top predators and native species tend to occupy the wildland part of the system. Way over in the human part of the system, that's where we have more humans, more weedy species and more native species that are adapted to humans, like magpies and raccoons and ravens. They're actually predators, and one of the reasons why many native species drop out is because these mesopredators get so abundant. This is the Little Bear subdivision out by Gateway. That's the one that where the fire had occurred right next to it. This is just illustrating how a rural subdivision tends to have an ecological footprint, that the area that is influenced by these mesocarnivores, by weedy species, by water pollution, by dogs and cats in their roaming, is much larger than the subdivision itself. And so that's why when you actually put these ecological footprints around rural subdivisions and roads, you end up with this much of GYE being in that developed condition. How does this development overlay various types of habitat? So we've done this analysis for things like aspen habitats and riparian communities, bird hotspots, moose habitat, pronghorn habitat. This is for all lands across GYE, the proportion that, quote, is now developed. That's the black in the maps, and the red is the suitable habitat. And you'll notice for some of these habitat types like riparian, sage grassland, pronghorn habitat, that the majority is now developed across the whole landscape. And on the private land parts of these habitats, for the riparian zone, for example, almost 90% of those private lands with those riparian habitats are now developed. So those types of ecological footprints are expanding over a fair whack of GYE. That translates into being pretty meaningful for actual population dynamics. You know, that's the kind of stuff that we really try to manage, we really care about, because we don't want species to decline in number. We want them to grow. But yet we found for a variety of types of native songbirds that are nesting in these very rich riparian cottonwood forests, that the number of offspring that they produce actually declines as a function of the number of homes that are in the surrounding landscape. And that this reproduction is so low in many of these places that have homes around them, that they're actually so-called population sinks. The population size would decrease if there weren't immigrants coming in from other places. So a lot of us love birds, and that's concerning. More people care about grizzly bears, and the same thing basically was found through population studies of the interagency grizzly bear team, where these orange areas are basically population sinks where the mortality, largely human-derived, is high enough to cause negative population growth in those places. So that led to this, where we city dwellers perhaps all are trying to get out to the wilderness, but the grizzlies, they're trying to get to the bird feeders into the garbage cans out there in the lowland private lands. Little do they know the pain that they will suffer when they get there, right? This might be the most surprising one. We're used to seeing white-tailed deer and mule deer around ranchettes and rural homes. In fact, they're eating on the green lawns. A study in Colorado just published did a very rigorous analysis over a 40-year period, and basically found that the ratio of fawns to does declined as a function of density of rural development in that area. And I think this is attributed to things like pets, dogs inflicting mortality on animals and actual loss of habitat. So when you look across these many species, we see these negative population effects related to some of this development. Now, there are some amazing good news stories at the same time, and grizzly bear is one of them. As you all know, we basically have one of the greatest wildlife recovery success stories anywhere in the world with grizzly bears and with bison and with wolves. So this is just showing their population sizes in GYE from 1970 to present. Despite those private lands and sink areas, federal and state land managers have been remarkably successful in actually creating a growing population of grizzly bears and an expanding population of wolves. A not so good news story is when we look into the future with regard to climate change. Just very briefly, this is sort of a composite of studies looking at how different tree species might respond to climate change up to 2100. Basically, the green here is showing the Douglas fir and lodgepole pine and subalpine forests as they presently are distributed across GYE. The brown is the sagebrush grassland and juniper savanna. Notice how much the area occupied by forest is projected to decline over this coming century, largely being replaced by what's now down in the valley bottoms. So when we think about that loss of forest area, what does that mean for snowpack and water retention and habitat? These are pretty big changes. Whitebark pine that lives up in the highest elevations is projected to have the biggest decline. This is the area projected to be suitable for the current time period in blue across GYE. Only about 3% of that remains suitable under the warmer climate projection for 2100. Okay, so when you look at all those consequences, how can you put it all together into something that just helps a variety of people understand what's the state of our ecosystem? Well, we came up with just this sort of simple color-coded approach to do that, basically showing a gradient from vital signs that are likely deteriorating to those that are improving. Just as a quick visualization of what aspects of the system are doing well and poorly. So notice that for the national parks and wilderness areas, that the majority of vital signs are stable or improving. And again, that's testimony to remarkably effective management. Private lands, much different story, with almost half of the vital signs perhaps showing likely deteriorating trends. And then for those vital signs that we forecast in the future, they're mostly showing deteriorating. So I guess this is the big take-home message, that in this iconic ecosystem that's known globally as the home of the first national park and one of the largest intact ecosystems in the temperate zone, we're actually having some decline in ecological vital signs particularly in the private land part of the ecosystem. So that really raises the challenge of, is this going to happen in our watch? What are we going to do about it? What will the future hold for us? So just briefly, I'd like to talk a bit about a possible approach, a framework for trying to better sustain this place in future times. It pretty much starts with the suggestion that we develop national biodiversity policy that includes consideration of these large wildlands and trying to keep them healthy. That within each of these large wildlands, we basically do large landscape conservation planning, something that's really now well developed in the conservation literature and being pretty widely practiced by most of the conservation groups and NGOs that are in Bozeman, for example. And then finally, we assess how well we're doing within each of these wildlands through a national assessment of how well we're sustaining them internally as how well we're maintaining connectivity among them. Let's just talk briefly about each of these pieces. First, national policy. It turns out just in the last year or two, there have been many high-profile calls for basically trying to develop a national habitat strategy or a national biodiversity policy, as illustrated by both of these. And then not yet published, but soon to be published, is this really interesting perspective in the Harvard Law Review by Robert Keeter. He was one of the founders of the concept of a Greater Yellowstone. He's a political scientist out of the University of Utah. He basically is calling for a federal law that would require federal agencies to collaborate across large wildland landscapes in their management, that there would actually be a requirement for very tight coordination among the Forest Service, the Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service. So there's a lot of momentum for trying to develop this sort of national scale policy. Thinking about what can be done within each of these wildlands, one of the first things is to basically take what we've learned over the last 50 years in Greater Yellowstone and apply it across the country. Basically, mapping these large wildland places and giving those that have not yet been named, giving them names, giving them identity to help the people that live within them and influence them really understand that they're part of a big wild system that's really important to their livelihoods and their economy. So this is just an example of our initial attempt to do an objective mapping of large wildlands. Where Dave Theobald and I are working on this across the U.S. This is depicting those large wildlands in our region. Within each of those, again, they will include a variety of state and federal jurisdictions. They'll include private lands. And that really leads to the need to basically include the various people that live and work and manage these systems, include them in the management, to include stakeholders within some sort of network governance, which is defined here. We know that this is remarkably challenging to do, but I'll just say that there are great examples within our ecosystem of success. You might have heard of this High Divide Collaborative. It's basically landowners and other stakeholders that are in the area between Yellowstone and the crown of the continent. And they've come together. They've identified these shared priorities. Just look at the bolded words here. Ranch lands, connectivity, recreation, headwaters, sage grouse, public access. You know, you might not think those things go together, but in reality, in our West, this is what a lot of people care about. And it's not that hard to find common ground because so many people care about these kind of issues. They've come together, they've identified which lands they think are most important to meet these objectives. And they've actually been able to garner, I think at this point, almost $50 million from the Land and Water Conservation Fund for conservation easements. That's a fantastic success story. You might know that we also have success in terms of coordination of our federal agencies, in terms of the Greater Yellowstone Coordinating Committee. It was actually formed, some 50 years ago. All the major, the five federal types of landowners are represented in this committee. They've convened some 10 different ecological subcommittees dealing with water and climate change and whitebark pine and grizzly bears. Over the last couple of years, they've tried to reach out to the public and have held three different public meetings, basically asking those private stakeholders how the federal government can best interact with them in trying to sustain these resources. On the science front, I guess this is kind of my specialty, and I would suggest we could do a much better job of taking the pulse of the ecosystem, of identifying what are the vital signs we really care about, of using all the great science that's out there to monitor trends in them, to evaluate change over time in them with this sort of red, yellow, green system, and then most importantly, to communicate these results to the wide variety of people that live and work in the system. Communicate in ways that resonate not with the scientists, but that resonate with the business community and the ranchers and others. And in that regard, we need to learn how to do this communication. And here's where there are real challenge and real opportunities to convert the science into something that means something to people. And I guess what I think is the real goal is just to allow the wide variety of stakeholders to have information about the health of the ecosystem, to draw on if they choose to when they make a decision about how they're going to manage their ranch, or whether a county commissioner is going to approve a subdivision, or how a septic tank would be installed and maintained. Basically, so that if people choose to care about the ecosystem when making decisions about land use, that they have the information on which to do so, along with economic information and political information and other things. Again, we have some great success in this, and I think the Interagency Grizzly Bear Study Group is just a fantastic example. So you remember this was in the Bozeman Chronicle 2 days ago? You probably all know within about 50 bears how many are in Greater Yellowstone, and you probably know what the trend has been over the last 50 years. It's been remarkably well documented, and it's been remarkably well communicated to the community. So 718 grizzly bears estimated in the ecosystem, a growing trend and a stable population. I'll skip by this one. In terms of this communication, we've got some really great successes in terms of David Quammen's featuring Yellowstone in National Geographic last year. That really painted why we need a greater ecosystem and what it is we love about this place and the diversity of people that are in it. I think that lays the groundwork for people really wanting to work towards sustaining the ecological health. And then more recently, Todd Wilkinson started this Mountain Journal that really has GYE as its beat. It's kind of a voice of GYE, and they're putting out all kinds of interesting system-wide information. I guess I would suggest the more of this we can do, the more we can really help stakeholders understand the state of the ecosystem and how they can help sustain it. Now, this is critical, so this is a lot of information, but basically it's a summary of how well are we monitoring the health of the ecosystem and how well are we reporting it. And you'll notice that for all these vital signs, that we're doing a pretty good job of monitoring them over time in our national parks, but not a very good job at all on private lands. And for very few of these are we actually evaluating trends over time. Is it improving or deteriorating? And then, again, very few of them are getting reported regularly in the media. So my hope is that we would change this. And so, again, all these key vital signs are pretty much widely known to citizens in the community. Once we know what are the more vulnerable elements, the elements that are at risk, you know, we really have a wide variety of instruments for trying to help solve these problems. Yeah, there are regulatory ones, but there are also incentive-based ones, and there are education-based ones, and collaborative conservation is really at the heart of all this. So we have a real opportunity to draw on, and I'm just giving examples in here from this region of success in this. One of the big successes in the land trusts and the amount of acreage they've been able to put into conservation easements. So red here are lands that are now in conservation easements. This is the rate of increase in area in easements from 1976 to present. You know, this is remarkably successful. And here's one place where Gallatin County stands out. We have a greater percentage of our county in easements than any of the 20 counties in GYE. That's a real success. And nationally, we're seeing the same sort of trends in expansion of easements. This all really comes down to individuals, and all the big science and communication and all that's important. But probably the real key thing is what is each of our own, whether we have a light touch with what we do or not when it comes to the ecosystem. And I think there's real opportunity just for helping people understand, whether they're ranch managers or ranchette owners or backcountry recreationalists or making decisions about city policy, ways that they can have a lighter touch ecologically and try to reduce some of this. And then finally, as we scale back out to the national level, there's a real need, of course, to assess connectivity between these large wildland ecosystems so that the grizzly bears from Yellowstone can connect with the crown of the continent. And those tree species, as climate change shrinks their habitat in Yellowstone, can move north into glacier. So I would just close out that I would suggest this is a framework that at least pieces of it are operable, and I guess I think would really make a difference if we could organize this in a systematic way. So you might say, yeah, get real, no way this could work. Well, let's look globally. Have you heard of the Convention on Biodiversity signed in 1910? Here are the countries of the world in green that have signed it, and the one that hasn't. So their goals are conservation of biodiversity, sustainable use of the components of biodiversity, sharing the benefits arising from the commercial and other utilization of genetic resources in a fair and equitable way. They've set 17 targets to be reached by 2020 among these countries. And they include things like expanding the protected area coverage, minimizing fragmentation, enhancing connectivity. We actually, our newest NASA study is basically using these remote sensing and science approaches to help countries develop conservation plans for meeting these targets by 2020. We're working with 8 countries in the humid tropics to do that. You know, when we have these kind of meetings with representatives from those countries, they don't say, no, we don't have a mandate to try to sustain ecological health. They say, give us the maps. Give us the information. When can you get it to us? Because they're committed to do this. So I would just say, we can do this in the U.S. if it's being done globally. So to conclude all this, you know, it's really clear that human pressure, climate change, these are building. They're eroding wildlands globally. Some of that's happening in GYE. We really need to do something about it at the national level. And particularly we need to make further progress in GYE fundamentally by scaling up the successes that we've had really to the ecosystem level. So I personally think these are really the four key things that we need to do in this system that would help a bunch. This science-y stuff about trends and vital signs, communicating that to the stakeholders in ways that really matter to them, really expanding these successful public and private collaboratives, and then effectively managing across these large landscapes, both the public and private lands, with ways that really respect stakeholders and are of stakeholder interest. So, with that, I would much thank you for your patience and attention, and look forward to any comments that you might have about this.